These days, most people find it easier to lock eyes with a screen than with another person. Yet we are innately social beings. So what happened? And what can we do about it? You're listening to Wellness 3.0, and I'm your host, Amy Backman. All right, welcome back, everybody, to Wellness 3.0. On this day's episode, we have Chad Littlefield talking with us. Chad is a co-founder and chief experience officer of We and Me, where he's on a mission to create conversations that matter. Forbes has called him a global expert on asking questions that build trust and connection in teams. Most recently, Chad and his business partner, Will Wise, launched their new book, Ask Powerful Questions, Create Conversations That Matter. We had so much fun in this interview and got to know a lot about Chad and how this all started for him, including how his passion for connecting started all the way back as a kid watching Robin Williams, what Chad thinks are the keys to asking powerful questions, how to start them, and how not to start them. We got into the true meaning of intention and how Chad really views intention as the foundation for all powerful conversations. We get into the difference between empathy and sympathy, and then what it takes to really strike up a conversation with somebody on a bus or a plane, and how not to feel uncomfortable afterwards. And finally, we'll learn from Chad how you can play a connection game with up to 8,000 people in a room. Sit back and relax and enjoy the conversation with Chad Littlefield. Hopefully you take something and have a powerful conversation after this episode. And I'm going to make sure that I'm saying your last name right. Littlefield. Yeah.
Yes. Like small yard.
Okay, cool. That's great. Is that what you say to people when you meet them?
That's what I say to insurance agents on the phone who need an extra boost in their day.
Yeah. It's Littlefield, like small yard. Well, Chad Littlefield, thank you for being on the show. I want to open by asking you to tell us a little story. It was a little story that I heard in your TEDx talk, and something about a small child blowing you off.
So I was giving this talk about taking positive social risks. And so it was actually in preparation for the TEDx talk. I said, okay, I have a handful of stories of me like failing and flopping, taking risks, but I want like a recent one. And so I was just kind of had the mindset of taking a bit more social risks than I would have maybe normally. And so I was walking down the street and with the like totally, totally positive intention of just making a connection and maybe sharing a smile. I looked over at this person who was wearing a green, bright lime green jacket. And it was the same color as mine. And so I just kind of looked over and I tossed from across the road. It's like, hey, it's a really nice lime green jacket. It's a great color on us. And she looked at me and just gave me the biggest eye roll you could imagine, like totally blowing me off. And my ego is a little bit dented, mostly by the fact that she was probably in like fourth grade or fifth grade. that added to the social pain of it all.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, is this something that you take on like as a practice, taking positive social risks?
Choicefully. So it's interesting, like writing a book about asking powerful questions and talking about positive social risks. Early on, like I found myself with this like immense pressure to constantly be taking positive social risks and constantly be stepping outside of my comfort zone and constantly connecting with people like in all places and walks and aspects of life. And it was way too much. It was way too much pressure. Like sometimes on a plane, all you need is a really good pair of sound isolating headphones, right? And I think sometimes there's a quote by I don't know who about how silence is one of the greatest arts of conversation. And I think that I believe, and I have a whole recent context to this language, but I believe that I exist on this planet to gently eradicate small talk. And I think that sometimes no talk is better than small talk. And we can unpack that further. I also don't think that small talk, I don't think small talk has anything to do with the content of what you're talking about. I think it has way more to do with the process of how you're talking about it. So I think you can talk about where you're from and the weather and what you do, and it can be a conversation that deeply, deeply matters. And I think you can talk about all three of those things and it doesn't matter at all.
Interesting. So the way or the intention for the small talk is what you're saying matters. Because I'm just thinking to the beginning of our conversation before we started recording, and we were talking about buying groceries online and how freaking amazing it is that you can do that. And what I noticed was there was so much enthusiasm coming out of both of us. And we were like, oh my God, we both made this big recent discovery. Isn't life amazing? And that is kind of what was underneath it all. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Totally. Yeah. It's like we wanted so genuinely to be there in that moment. Like there was nothing else. Like I didn't feel like you had somewhere else to be that was more important. I was like aiming to be anyway, like fully present in that moment and shutting everything else. And so I think, and you said the word like intention for me of thinking about making, like building, really building relationships of trust and deepening connection. I think at the foundation, if I were to draw out a pyramid of skills or my skills and mindsets of creating that relationship of trust, intention would be like the absolute like foundation of that, because you can ask any question and it may help you connect, but it may not. If your intention is to get and harvest information, it's going to be received very differently than if your intention is genuine curiosity, right? Those like two different conversations, same content, same words, very different process.
Yeah. I mean, we do feel like there's been studies to show that we have an energy field that picks up on the energy of others around us. I don't know how this works when you're virtual, right? Because it's probably a little bit different, but I can feel if you're just trying to dig information out of me versus truly here for a different reason. So that makes a lot of sense to me. And I heard you say, if I was to draw a pyramid, I think you've drawn this pyramid before, and I was going to ask about that pyramid. So I found this as the Ask Powerful Questions pyramid. And can you explain this to us a little bit? And we'll put an image of this in the show notes or a link to it so people can check it out themselves too.
Cool. Yeah. So I first learned this content and really got it from my current business partner, Will Wise, who is just like, his last name fits him very well. He's a wise guy. And the context that I learned it in, that I actually met him and where this pyramid came about. So for those of you who are listening and picturing a pyramid and it is in Egypt and not on a piece of paper, what you can picture is this pyramid where intention is the foundation and there are multiple layers that we believe that are the and have noticed are the core components of what allows you to go from zero to deeper connection relatively quickly, because the material actually came out of Will and I were training. We were working for an organization called World in Conversation, and World in Conversation puts about 8,000 plus strangers every year in a room with 8 to 10 other strangers in a circle to talk about stuff you're typically not supposed to talk about for 90 minutes with the sole purpose of gaining a deeper understanding of the other. So talking about really fuzzy things like race, gender, long-term conflict, politics, religion, like things that are usually hard, that are usually create separation rather than connection. And those dialogues were facilitated by two people. And so if it was a dialogue around race relations, there would be one person of color and one white person in the dialogue. If it was a dialogue about something else, you know, try to have opposing viewpoints, but the facilitator's aim was to stay neutral. And so when, if you can imagine sitting in an empty room and eight strangers walk in, they probably don't want to be there. And you're about to tell them they're going to talk about race relations for the next 90 minutes. Like you've got to be really, really good at establishing that rapport and that relationship of trust really quickly. And so the questions pyramid is the structure that we would actually train those facilitators. And taking it out, it's so applicable outside of the context. Like when I first really practiced and embodied the material, I feel like I re-met my mother for the first time. I feel like I found things out about my grandma that I never would have discovered before she passed away. And like opened, it just unlocked this whole new dimension to connection.
So can you take us through what that looked like? I mean, I see on here we have going from bottom to top, intention, rapport, openness, listening, and empathy. You know, tactically, what does that conversation look like with your mom?
Yeah. Okay. So I'll try to give you a sample. You know, my job now is traveling around and working with organizations for hours or days at a time on this stuff. So in short form, we'll share some low-hanging fruit that particularly was powerful for me to change. So starting at the level of intention, the pyramid structure in a way that, like, if you're in connection with somebody, you're in conversation, you're in an interaction, and it's not working, like something just feels broken, like you're not connecting, there's frustration or animosity starting to build, you can always drop down one level in the pyramid. And you can always drop down to the base of the pyramid, which is intention. And so intention, the Latin root to the word intention actually means to stretch, which is interesting because I think about a really good intention, kind of like a rubber band or an elastic that stretches over the needs of the whole. So if I'm in a conversation right now with just you, Amy, and I were to put out an intention, but it's not just us, right? There's other people listening. And so if my intention was included the needs of the whole, it might look like something along the lines of, you know, my intention in this conversation is to share a piece of what I know so that it can be like immediately useful and applicable to everybody who's listening right now. So that when you take out of your headphones and you shut your car door and you see the person that you work with and have worked with for 10 years, that you have, that you're better equipped to connect with them. So the tool, or like the really clear, tangible, pick-upable tool about this could be ethereal word of intention is being really clear, getting really clear about what your intention is and sharing it with the other person. Because I think so often we have intentions that include other people, but we don't clue them into what they are. And so when an intention is shared, like Mr. Manipulation has to pack its bags and leave. Like manipulation can't be present when intentions are really, really clear in a group. And when you hop on and look at a Facebook argument and people are just going back and forth about whatever, it's likely that there's not a really clear intention. Right. Or maybe the intention is to win, which is not stretched to include the needs of the whole.
I'm about to have a belated Father's Day celebration with my dad this coming weekend because I'm going to be in person with him. And I'm just thinking about that conversation. We're going to do some storytelling and documenting that for a book. I imagine that coming into that, I could be like, I want to make sure that he feels like this is the best Father's Day gift and that he feels like, you know, I really did a good job, right? Or I can say this is for the whole family to receive this book and future generations to receive this book. And that changes everything.
Totally so, changes everything.
Wow.
And it doesn't, including the needs of the whole doesn't mean includes everyone all the time. Sometimes it might be that our intentions, like if there wasn't some people virtually joining us and listening in, my intention might be just for the two of us, or might just be focused on one person, but can't just, it has to be focused on a we rather than just a me.
Yeah, I love that. So can you take us up the pyramid then?
Sure. Okay. Rapid fire. So intention, we've got a little bit of a base, being clear about that. Bumping up one level, the way that we define rapport is a relationship of trust. And it's not one that necessarily takes years and years to create. And so I'll share a story of complete failure. One of the tools that we will teach both organizations, educators, and that I once learned is to build a relationship of trust from zero, meaning stranger on the street or like in an elevator, is by noticing what somebody's wearing, carrying, or sharing and asking a question rooted in your own natural curiosity about that. Part of the reason that we do that is because what we're wearing, carrying, and sharing oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes was a choice. And usually when we wake up in the morning, we don't look like we do at noon. And so we make some choices about how we want to represent ourselves in the world. And so asking about what somebody's wearing, carrying, or sharing is a safe way to access a piece of who they are, not just like whether or what do they do. And so it's like, well, if you have a logo on your shirt, it's cool for me to ask because you chose to put on that shirt. You knew you were coming out in public and it probably connects to a piece of your story. And so part of the training that we used to do at Penn State University when Will and I were teaching there was we'd be in the middle of this 3-hour workshop. We would pause and we would invite students to take a half hour, leave the room, and their only objective in that half hour was build a relationship of trust with three strangers and then come back in and see how it went. And so this one time, like after doing this so many times, I was not feeling it this time. I was not interested. And I was like, okay, if I have to do this and I'm teaching this material and I don't want to preach when I'm not practicing, I might as well run an errand. So I went downtown to a convenience store. And as I'm checking out, there's this woman wearing really bright colored tattoos all across her neck and upper chest. And I'm like, oh, this is like, I'm so curious about this. And so I'm buying my pack of gum. And I just look up and with like so much natural genuine curiosity, I'm like, oh, you're like, you have to tell me, like, I'm so curious. What's the story behind your tattoos? And she goes, I like the colors, which was like a huge no, get away, not interested in conversation with you right now. See you later. So we get back to the room a half hour later and the energy is just like buzzing. 30 students have just had this like three experiences with strangers, like some good, some bad, so all over the place. And this one student, he shares first. He's like, oh my gosh, I have to share this. First of all, when you rolled out this assignment, I was pretty ticked. I did not want to do this. I did not sign up for this. I wasn't interested in this. This was way outside of my comfort zone. But I figured if I had to do it, I might as well run an errand. And so I went downtown to this convenience store. And as I'm checking out, there's this woman wearing bright colored tattoos all across her neck and upper chest. And I looked at her and I said, how annoying does it get when people are constantly asking you about your tattoos? And she just lost it. She like, the way he described it, hunched over and was just like, oh my gosh, you have no idea. Like it's sometimes I just wish I never got them. In fact, there was just this guy in here asking, what's the story behind your tattoo? Blah, blah, blah. Right. So like all this is pouring out and the difference in this story skips up the pyramid a little bit because I would say, well, let's play a little game. What would you say it was the difference between my failure and his success?
There's something around going out on a limb and creating some empathy for what somebody may be going through.
Boom. That's the word right there. Like the difference between the intent was there, right? The intent was there. I was very positive on both of our halves, but I was so focused on my curiosity and not on hers. And so if we skip two layers and jump up to the top of this Ask Powerful Questions pyramid, empathy sits there. And if everything's sandwiched in between intention and empathy, we'll often say empathy is stepping into somebody else's shoes. One of the ideas that Will gave to me that I really, really has stuck with me is actually empathy is stepping into one of somebody else's shoes. I think that sympathy might be stepping into both of somebody's shoes and feeling exactly what they feel as they feel it. But then you lose yourself and your own reality and your curiosity and you can't actually be of service. Yeah, you can't be rooted in your own world too. And so in that moment, I would say he stepped behind the counter and stepped one of his feet into her shoes and said, what must it be like for you meeting hundreds of people every day and having these super brilliant, colorful tattoos all over? So the two bits in between to fulfill your assignment of going all the way up, up one level from rapport is you take the natural, genuine curiosity that's built at that level and you open your questions up. So openness, the level above it, has two kind of meanings. One is openness to, I think that when we ask questions of people or we go to connect, we take on the responsibility to really witness and be present for what they share. And that's not always easy because sometimes when you ask things, like you hear things that are big, they're heavy, or they're joyful, or they're jealousy inducing, or they're like, there's all these things that people's responses bring on. And I just think we have to have the openness for whatever comes out and being able to be present with that. And then the second one is much more literal. It's literally opening up your questions. So open questions versus closed. And so we actually teach people in that chapter, and when we're working together in person, to ask questions that only begin with how and what and not why, which is really ticks some people off, because not asking why questions is kind of a big deal for some people, because like Simon Sinek wrote a whole book about it. He did like one of the most popular TED Talks about finding your why. And it's not about like that type of why, is about finding purpose. For us, if the goal is to build a relationship of trust with somebody else, how and what questions tend to open up questions and responses much more.
There's so much practical, like I can take what you're saying and go apply it, you know, immediately right now in this conversation. And that's kind of blowing my mind right now, because I'm imagining you guys doing the work in the organizations that you work with and how quickly you must see results.
Yeah. It's like the moment that somebody leaves a workshop or a keynote, like I just got back from Cartagena, Colombia, doing a keynote with people in 40 plus countries. And they were all like, it was translated through like headsets, like the UN. And so I don't know what the words, how and what in their language was necessarily, but taking that back, like it's a really tangible tool that, and that's one of the tools that helped me re-meet my grandma. By default, we ask a lot of dud questions, even if they're rooted in curiosity. Like we asked questions like, did you like this? As opposed to what did you like about this?
Yeah.
And so when you open that up and you just listen, now there are exceptions to the rule, right? You can ask what time is it? And that's a very closed question. And you can ask how many of those. And so for every good rule, there's always a reason to break it. But in general, if you want to trick your brain into asking better questions, like if you're going to say a sentence that ends in a question mark, start it with a how or what, because it'll just by default actually make you more deliberate about the questions you're asking, which will make the question better. Because most of the time we don't actually think about questions that we're asking, or and most of the time we don't actually even ask questions to begin with.
So I have a question that begins with how or what.
You can ask questions that begin with any word, Amy.
So I really want to know, I mean, clearly you've been doing this work for a long time. I know you're not that, you don't appear to be quite that old. So I am imagining you've done this from college onward or something around there. And I'm really curious, like, how did this deep desire to have conversations that matter come to be? Like, where did that come from? Is there a life event that you can link this to when you were younger? Like, this is clearly your calling. This is your why.
Yeah. Where did that come from is a lovely question. And I don't need to judge your questions moving forward. So ask whatever you'd like. And we can
don't worry, I'll do it for you.
So if any of you have seen the movie Patch Adams before with Robin Williams, where he becomes at this point it's like an ancient scroll. It came out like 1995 or something. But in the movie, he becomes a doctor to really promote the quality of life over quantity. And he just has this totally magical way of reaching and empathizing with patients that even the best, smartest, wisest clinicians can't. Like they're really great at the physical health part, but they're not so great at the social health part. And so anyway, I saw that movie when I was half the height I am now, sometime in fifth grade or something. And I had my whole life figured out. I was like, I was going to be Patch Adams. I was going to be a doctor. And then I took a chemistry class in college and was like, okay, maybe this isn't going to work so good. And what I realized through a little, you know, moment of life crisis, I'm like, yikes, I don't know that in order to be Patch Adams, I don't know that I need to go to medical school for 12 years to learn how to hold a scalpel. And so what I recognized is that I was really enamored with the way, in the movie anyway, Robin Williams was able to actually heal people through human connection. Actually, like physically, people got better. They took their medicines more frequently, more consistently because of this personal connection. And so I just set out with the, like, what I hope is a lifelong endeavor and quest to figure out, like, is that true? Like, can that happen? Can we actually heal people through social connection? And from the last decade of research and experience with groups, unequivocally, absolutely yes. Absolutely yes, we can heal people through human connection. And there's a whole bunch of super cool research that your other guests are probably sharing about, that coming out of Harvard and other places, that says, yeah, like that our strong ties are really, really important.
Yep. Yep. Do you have a definition for what a real connection is?
Ooh.
How would you define that?
Yeah. So, you know, on the bottom of our connection toolkit box, we have a definition of connection from Brené Brown, which I like. And the way that I would tweak it is, if you've been picturing this Ask Powerful Questions pyramid of intention, rapport, openness, listening, and empathy, to the left side of that, on the other face of the pyramid, are phrases like, I am willing to know you as a base. I see you. I hear you, I understand you, and ultimately I'm actually with you. And so for me, a really great connection is where someone's really willing to know you, they see you, they hear you, they understand you, and they're with you.
Hmm. And that is that Brené?
That's not Brené. No. That comes from the book. Brené, you want to hear Brené's? I don't remember it verbatim.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, we want to hear Brené's quote. Of course we do.
For those who cannot see you, which is everybody but me, you're pulling out your connections toolkit box, which we'll have to talk more about as well. So let's hear it. What you got?
Yeah. So Brené's definition of connection, she says, I define connection as the energy that exists between people when they feel seen, heard, and valued, when they can give and receive without judgment, and when they derive sustenance and strength from the relationship.
Hmm. Yeah, I love that too.
They're both really good.
Yeah.
I think much more important than the definition of connection, I think that in general, we and people don't give themselves enough credit for how socially intelligent we are. And I think you know connection when it's happening. And the best way, I forget who gave me this metaphor, but you know, if you went to France and you didn't speak French and you went to a restaurant and you didn't know what to order and you're like, oh shoot, I don't know what to order. Like, you wouldn't go and learn French before you ordered. Like, you would just get the first thing on the menu, or you'd ask the waiter or waitress for their favorite thing and you'd try that. And if you didn't like it, you'd get something else. And if you didn't like it, you'd get something else. And I think similarly with connection, rather than trying to like just get it right the first time, like just try it. And if it didn't work, try it maybe one more time. And if it didn't work, try something else. And like continue doing that. That's part of the idea of like this phrase, positive social risk, that we were talking about earlier. Like, there's risk always involved in connection, but if your intentions are positive, like 99% of the time, you land on the side of connection making progress.
And the times that we do fail, we learn by doing it over and over that the world is not going to come crumbling down. The person who, for whatever reason, did not accept that connection request, energetic connection request, they just kept on living their lives. They didn't just go scream at you. I mean, all these fears that I think we have that are completely unfounded, they begin to show up as, This is just not what's going to happen if I do fail in taking on this risk. So it builds that muscle to recognize that, you know what, if this doesn't go so well, I can just keep on going with my day. I'm sure you didn't really even falter when that fourth grader didn't reciprocate, right? You just kept going.
It feels like, oh my gosh, like I would never, like I could never make a comment or like talk to a stranger like on a cold, dark bus, because like that's not normal. It's not what we do. And that is true. That's not normal. It's not what we typically do. But if you do it, the perceived risk is always so much higher than the actual risk, like tenfold higher than the actual risk. Now, there's like context. Like, I'm not suggesting you go ask somebody, what is life teaching you right now in a dark alley at 12 p.m. in the middle of Denver, right? Like, their context does matter. And on the whole, our risks toward connection end up creating connections. Mm-hmm. Like, go figure.
Do you ever have that moment where you are on that plane or on that bus or wherever, and you've struck up that conversation with a stranger and you are having an awesome connected time in this conversation, and then it just subsides because you're done having your conversation, but you're still sitting next to each other. I have this experience where that happens and then I can energetically feel the walls coming back up. Mm. And then I get a little bit in my head about that because it was just so strong. And now we're back to two strangers sitting next to each other feeling awkward, at least I am. And then, you know, one of us gets up to leave or the plane lands and you go, you know, Chad, have an awesome visit with your family. And it's right back. Do you know what I'm talking about? That feeling?
I totally do. And I've had just as many experiences along those lines. And what I would say, you said wall, I would say lack of clear intention. And so what I've tried, and I don't always do this, and I fail more times than I succeed at this, but when I'm really present and I'm on my game, the way that, like, if we're in conversation and I know, like, whoa, this is like, I'm going to Europe. Like, this is a long flight. I don't know if I can talk for 8 hours. I don't know if either of us want to talk for 8 hours. Just being really clear, going back to the foundation of the pyramid, being really clear about your intention of saying, hey, I really love this conversation and I'm going to get some quiet time and catch up on some reading and just kind of zoom out for a little while and maybe we'll chat later. Intention's clear. They're on board with it. You're on board with it. And like whatever wall you felt like, I don't think might remain. So a connection challenge for the next time you're on a plane, perhaps.
Yeah, that's great. And that will be on Friday. So I love the simplicity of that. I could feel just hearing you say that. I could feel how that would diffuse any of that, you know, theoretical wall going up. It's interesting. It reminds me of when we started working on Fabric, we came from a background of 4 or 5 years of running a mindful dating app called Meet Mindful. And so much of our world was rooted in mindfulness, that being just one of the core ethos of the business, of the team, of our why, of how we made decisions. And it's interesting to hear you say that just taking a moment to check in with your intention is enough to completely shift what might happen for, in this case, in your example, hours on an international flight. And that takes a high degree of self-awareness and mindfulness to just check in and say, what is it that I actually want right now? And then to go the next step and express that. So I'm just really present to how those things tend to coincide.
Well, let's up the stakes a tiny bit. So yes, it can change the trajectory of your flight. Hopefully not literally change the trajectory. But there's at a high level leadership meeting at HP Hewlett Packard, somebody came up and they were kind of writing their strategy and planning for the future. And somebody on the board was written, we want to be the best in the world, right? We want to be the best in the world. And somebody came up to the board and with a marker just crossed out the word in and wrote for. We want to be the best for the world. And so like one word totally shifted the intention. Now, I'd really love to be able to complete that story and tell you like what happened because of that. I can't, but I think that it illustrates like at a scale, like one word at any scale, depending on no matter what context you are in life, like, yeah, it can shift your relationships, but zoom out, like it can shift culture, it can shift the conversation, it can shift the world that we're operating in.
So speaking of words, this reminds me that you guys have decks of We Connect cards, and that I heard you say before we started recording that they're being used in more than half the countries in the world. For the world, in the world. And looking into how these cards are separated, and I'd love for you to talk more about this. We have the fun and light sections, the fun and light cards, the ones that go a bit deeper and the ones that are for self-reflection. And when I saw that, I really got curious about what is an example of self-reflection cards, and why do you think that that part is important as these are connection cards between two people?
Yeah. So yes, the cards are color coded. So the three categories they just shared are green, tend to be fun and light. Purple cards encourage some level of self-reflection, and blue go a little bit deeper. The reason that we included purple cards, and what there's a number of exercises that you can do with them, both in group, in pairs, solo. And so you could take all the purple self-reflective cards and say, for the month of January, like, I just want to reconnect with myself before I start connecting with others. And every day you pick a purple card and that's your journaling prompt, right? And so that's one way that you can use them solo, but we included that third category because the other way is to use them in groups. I've probably led this exercise with about 150,000 people in the last few years. And it's where everybody gets a card, gets a question. They pair up with each other and they have a conversation on those cards. And then they swap cards, toss their hand in the air, signaling that they're looking for a new person to chat with, and then pair up with them. So this is really beautiful, self-facilitating. You can be in conversation as long or as little as you want. And that is a bit of an extrovert-friendly activity. It's like it gets loud and everybody's talking and you have these short chats and some of them go deep and some of them are playful and spark laughter. We included purple to carve out space for the introverts to say that a lot of these questions, we put them in the deck because you've likely never been asked this question. And so when just by hearing it and by thinking of the response, you're actually creating new neural pathways and that takes time. But we live in this culture where even 3 seconds of silence feels strange. And so purple cards was just the invite to, like, if you're asked a question and you don't have an immediate response, feel free to pause and take the extra time that oftentimes is really useful for people who tend to be introverted, have that time to think.
What's an example of a purple card question?
Ooh, should I pull one out? Let's see. Example of a purple card question could be, what is something you know really well? What's a goal you plan on accomplishing this year? What is difficult for you now, but was easy as a child?
I feel like some of these are really good for conversation between two people. And I can see how they would be affected both ways, for journaling, for personal reflection, and for really awesome conversations.
Yeah, and they're intended and written in that context. An accidental discovery was that all the questions also happen to be written in a way that you can add context to the end of each question to, like, make it specific to your group. So, for example, what is a goal you plan on accomplishing this year at work, at home, at school, with your significant other, with somebody you just met? Like, right, there's all these contexts, and then you change the entire deck. So now it's 60 new questions that are, like, specifically for you.
Mm-hmm. So earlier when we were talking, you talked about how you guys came up with these questions using the Stanford Design Thinking Framework. And can you talk a little bit more about that? And I'm especially curious, how did you come up with the original list of questions that you were testing?
Yeah. So that back when I was my nerdy academic self and not practicing connection as much, we used Stanford's design thinking model and piloted with 3 groups and tested, like, hundreds of times. And there was lots of ways we did them, but part of the design thinking cycle is just rapid prototyping. So the original way that we came up with the 60 questions was me and a Google Doc with a handful of questions. And then I reached out to 10, like, really expert facilitators who I respected, who I knew were great question askers, great listeners, and they were masters of inviting people to connect. And I said, if you could only ask, like, 2 or 3 questions to connect with people for the rest of your life, what questions would you ask? And so I took some of those questions from, you know, I don't know how many hundreds of years of experience that was sitting in that group. And then those made it into the list. And so the list kept growing. And then eventually when we went to test and refine them down, we used this. This is not part of Stanford's model. I'm not sure where this came from, actually, but I call it the traffic light method. And we literally set out a red piece of construction paper, a yellow piece of construction paper, and a green piece of construction paper, and had hundreds of groups, hundreds of times, sort the deck. So we gave them, like, a whole deck of the current 60 question batch, and had them sort them into red questions, like, ooh, don't ask me that again, didn't help me connect with anybody, it wasn't fun to answer. Yellow, like, almost there, but, like, might need tweaking. And green was like, this is a really good question, I loved answering it, and it happened to, like, really accelerate the relationship of trust that we were aiming to create. And so we did that over and over and over again until the questions were like way heavily skewed in the green and a few in the yellow, and you can't make everybody happy. And so maybe there was a question or two in the red.
Oh, wow. I just passed a note over to our producer and I was like, we need to order this deck of cards. we generally ask one question of the group once a week in our team. And we have a long list of questions that I can't remember where they came from, but I just am so eager to not only do it in a round robin way or popcorn style, which is generally how we do it, or even on Slack. But I'm interested in doing it in the way that you talked about, with the group all standing in a room together and kind of passing the cards off to one another. That sounds really cool. So thanks for that tip.
Yeah. In a couple of weeks, I'm going to be heading up to do that question swap with a group of 8,000 people in Wisconsin. So like that is going to, one of the reasons I love it is you can do it with 12 people and you can do it with 1,200 people, because it doesn't matter how many, and yet people are still able to kind of choose. One of the reasons that, and the framing that I feel like is really important, is reminding people before an exercise like that, that reminding people that we have 100% autonomy in how we actually respond to questions. And so when somebody asks you, what is life teaching you right now? You can share something that's really deep and real and authentic. And you can also share that the temperature in the room is a little too high. Right. And that is such an empowering thing to remind people of, that like you get to choose the level of connection. And when you frame up that choice, most often people choose to go deep. But
oh, that's cool. It's like a little mind trick to get permission.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's one of the reasons we ended up including the color coding in the final design, because when people get a green card, they're like, oh, this will be fun and light. And so they end up like, they actually become energetically a little bit more jovial. And then blue questions, like you can't really color code questions. Like a purple question, like some of the purple questions could be blue questions, but because it's purple, because it's blue, it brings out a different part of who you are and allows you to answer differently. So it'd be like, oh, like this is a blue question. Like, whoa.
Beautiful. We're going to close up with a few of our standard ways of closing here at Wellness 3.0. And the first being a little game that we like to call connectivity games. And it's really just another name for what you guys do in your work all day long. And you have said one question multiple times that I would like to kick back to you. And we can use this one to play our connectivity. So Chad Littlefield, what is life teaching you right now?
Ooh. If you could see, if everybody could see this, I would show you a picture of me and my wife, Kate, holding a ultrasound picture, because I'm going to be a dad in the next handful of months. And so right now, life is teaching me to soak it all in. Like I just want to absorb everything around me, because I know, and I'm not, I know that I will mourn my current life in some capacity. But right now, like I'm not mourning. I'm just like soaking it in, and I'm excited for this new life that I don't even know what's in store, but I have a feeling I'm going to be going back to school for the next 18 plus years. And the subject is going to be connection, belonging, and trust. And a very little person is going to be teaching me a lot about it.
I foresee a future offshoot of your work coming from this new school.
Totally.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you want me to answer?
I do. I was going to ask, but I thought you might just go for it. But I do want to know what life is teaching you right now.
You know, what comes to mind for me is, and this goes back to the intention part of your connection pyramid, is staying connected to what matters most and having all of my actions ladder up to that intention in whatever part of my life that may be, and not getting too wrapped up in the smaller details of the stuff and of the doing and of the decision making without reminding myself of what those larger intentions are. And I can see that on a business level. I can see that in my partnership with my boyfriend. I can see that in my health as well. And so that's a big one, is I think to get less wrapped up in the, I don't know, like the silo situations, and more like, what is the greater purpose of each of these things?
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you for that. So we're going to close with asking you, it's a two-part question. What is, or how would you define social wellness, knowing that this feels like just a new budding area of focus that still, I think there's still a lot of conversations to be had that get to a definition. And maybe there is no perfect definition, but how do you define social wellness? And then what is one clear action or challenge that you could give people that they could take on this week?
Oh, I love it. So if you think about that ladder of, I'm willing to know you, I see you, I hear you, I understand you, I am with you, I think that my current belief, understanding, and perspective on social health is the mirror image of that, or the receiving end of all of those things. And so having somebody who's willing to know you and being seen and being heard and feeling understood and having somebody who's truly with you, somebody or multiple people who are truly with you, I think that if you've got that, that there's an immense amount of social health that shows up there, social well-being. And to your second question, I could pick actionable, hopefully you've got some actionable stuff already, but I could pick more from any part of the ladder. But I'll give you a twofer. So the first would be intention. Like right now, pause, assuming you're not driving, pause and look at your calendar, whatever system you use, and find a meeting that you feel like is particularly important. It might be like the chance to get a new client. It might be opportunity to meet with somebody really cool within your organization. It might be firing somebody that you really don't want to fire, but you have to. And in that calendar invite, or wherever you have it, spend a minute, even just sit, literally 60 seconds, getting clear about your intention for that meeting, and actually write it down and commit to yourself and maybe somebody else to actually sharing that intention in the first 5 minutes of your meeting. And just notice how that meeting totally has the ability to shift that way. So that's one. The second one would be definitely immediately applicable. Turn on your natural, genuine curiosity. So on average, there's not really great research on this, but what I've been able to dig up, on average, kids between the ages of 2 and 5 ask about 300 to 400 questions a day. Adults ask about 6 to 12, not 100, like 6 to 12 questions a day. And so like, where did our curiosity go? And I think that the amount that kids are like absorbing and learning and soaking in about the world, I think, first of all, we'd have to live to age 3,300 something to ask as many questions as a 2 to 5 year old does in just those 3 years at the cadence of 6 to 12 questions a day. And so my invite or my tip would be double it. See what happens if you just double it. And if you want to double it again the next week, go for it, but just double it. I don't think we need to ask 300 to 400 questions a day. That would be very interrogative, but just asking a little bit more questions. And one trick to do that is like, when the next time you hear somebody share something that feels like, wow, like, thank you for sharing that, commit to yourself to responding with a sentence that ends in a question mark, not a period.
Amazing. Amazing. Really, really.
Oh, that was fun.
Can we talk again soon?
I would love that. I would love
it. Boom, nailed it. Ended in a question mark. Okay. No, really, this has been such a pleasure speaking to you and getting to know you. And I know this will not be the last time that we talk. And just excited to see about the work that you guys are doing and taking something that can be so nebulous and hard and inaccessible and sometimes too woo-woo. And just all this stuff that people have built around connection and deep conversation, and making it just so doable in organizations that are really providing ripple effects all around the world. And so bless you for the work that you're doing, and I'm excited to know you.
Mucho gusto en conocerla.
Ooh.
Yeah.
listening, everybody. If you're looking for more examples of easy ways to connect and have powerful conversations and ask powerful questions, you can check out Chad's work along with his connection toolkit at weand.me. So the company is We and Me, and the URL is weand.me. Don't forget to subscribe to Wellness 3.0, available on iTunes, Google Play Music, Spotify, and Stitcher. And if you're loving the show, we'd love for you to rate us and leave a review. It's how we can continue to spread the word about the importance of social wellness in the world. Thanks so much.